This is Beverly Tomasian. Welcome to our Diabetes Fundamental course. Today we'll be talking about nutrition and exercise and providing some of the latest information on helping our patients move toward eating more healthily and getting. And so we each come with our life experiences. And so somewhere we're going to try and meet in the middle and work on a plan together. So I have my own particular style of doing things based on my life experience. That's what I so I just want to like acknowledge and account for that. So I'm not that excited about this plate method. I generally like a little bit different plate method, but this there are some things I like about this. It says switch to low fat free or low fat milk, get whole grains, look for sodium-rich foods and try and limit those and drink water instead of sugary drinks. So I like that part. And I'll show you the plate that I like a lot better. Here it is. I like this plate better. So you can go online and just look up plates that you like and see that match your philosophy. But this plate I like because it has half of it is these beautiful array of vegetables and there's different colors and there's cruciferous and lettuce and tomatoes and lots of fiber there. And then there's beans and rice and a little bit of chicken here, which is one quarter of the total serving of the plate. So one quarter is the protein, one quarter is the starch, and then here's the vegetables. And I love that on the side, there's this beautiful orange and also a glass of water. How much better does it get than that? So kind of look around and see what works for you. The thing we do know that nutrients affect blood sugar in different way. As you can see, here's carbohydrate. These are what we call the macronutrients, carbohydrate, protein, and fat. Well, carbohydrate or starches get in quickly after we eat. Within 15 minutes, we're going to see a spike in the blood sugars, and then that spike lasts for up to an hour, and then it comes back down again, back to baseline. So that's why we like to have patients check their blood sugars 1 to 2 hours after eating to see how well the pancreas released insulin to get that blood sugar down. So this is a fully functional pancreas. It released enough insulin to utilize the glucose from the carbohydrate and get it stored into the muscle cells, into the liver cells. And so that's the reason we check 1 to 2 hours after. Of course, if a person with diabetes eats carbohydrates and they combine it with protein and fat, that absorption rate may be effective, and we call effective, and that's the pizza effect. So pizza, for example, has a lot of fat from the cheese. So a lot of patients might see a delayed spike in the blood sugars because that carbohydrate absorption may be a little bit delayed because of the fat in the pizza. Okay, so protein doesn't really affect blood sugars. Fat, you can see 3 to 4 hours later, there's a little bump. But the thing that does affect blood sugars most is glucose, I'm sorry, carbohydrates. Carbohydrates affect post-meal blood glucose. So when patients are trying to figure out why do my blood glucose go high after a meal, we often investigate how much carbs they were eating. So let's kind of take a look at one carb serving in our next poll question. Which of the following equals about 15 grams of carbohydrate? And there's more than one right answer. A, a small bagel. B, 1 1/4 cup of strawberries. C, a cup of milk. D, a half a cup of rice. Or E, a half a cup of Jell-O. So let me go ahead and launch that poll. And there's, as I mentioned, more than one right answer on this one. Thanks for voting, everybody. Okay. I'm going to go ahead and close this because you guys are looking really good. I'm going to share. So nobody chose a small bagel. That's excellent because a small bagel is, well, a large bagel, 60 grams of carbohydrate or 4 servings. Maybe a small bagel is, I don't know, 30 to 45 grams, but that's wrong. Okay, you are right on B. 1 1/4 cup of strawberries is 1 serving or 15 grams of carbohydrate. So I love saying to my patients, have strawberries. They're wonderful. They're full of fiber and nutrients, and they are not that high in carbohydrate, you know, looking at the quantity. You can get a lot of quantity, and it's not going to make your blood sugar go crazy. A cup of milk. Yes, a cup of milk is actually 12 grams of carbohydrate, but we generally say it's about one serving. So milk has lactose in it, and that's milk sugar. It will raise your blood sugar. So on D, half a cup of rice. That is not the right answer. It's actually a third of a cup of rice. So a third of a cup of rice is one serving of carbohydrate or 15 grams. So you can imagine a cup, which is your closed fist, is three servings of rice. So for a lot of people who rice is their main source of carbohydrate, this is really difficult for them to manage and to, to really adhere to or to be conscious of. But some of my patients who love rice say, "I'm not going to eat rice anymore. I'm just forget it." No, rice is okay, and brown rice, of course, is always better. But just watch the portions. Okay, E, half a cup of Jell-O. Yes, that is 15 grams of carbohydrate, so that is right. And so sometimes you just need Jell-O. If you're going to have Jell-O as a snack, just have a half a cup. Or you could eat sugar-free Jell-O. If it's sugar-free Jell-O, it's carbohydrate-free. And so I think this is really helpful to know to get a feeling of what is one serving of carbohydrate, just to be familiar with that. Now, as I've mentioned earlier, the American Diabetes Association says there is no one serving size or recommendation of macronutrients for people with diabetes. So now I have this slide which says how much carbohydrate per meal. And I just provide this as a guideline because sometimes my patients do ask me, "Beverly, just tell me how many grams or how many servings of carbohydrate can they have per meal?" So I do want to give you these general guidelines just to help patients get started. And of course, if they're very active and men and they're, doing physical labor, they're going to need more than this. But this is kind of just for your, I guess, average adult who's, yeah. So 45 to 60 grams of carb per meal, which is 3 to 4 servings. And when I tell patients this, I'm very clear, this is not for the day. This is per meal. I don't know why they just think, "Oh, I get 60 grams for the day." No, per meal. And then if they're going to have a snack, I just say really try and limit it to 15 grams. If they're a bigger person, 30 grams. So that's kind of the recommendation. The recommended daily allowance of carbohydrates is 130 grams. And sometimes I get a lot of patients who are doing carb deprivation. I don't know if you've met them, but they're just like, "I'm not eating any carbs," or, "I'm eating 40 grams of carb a day because I'm trying to get my blood sugars down." I do worry about those people because anytime you're avoiding a complete macronutrient, you're missing a lot of good nutrition and fiber and phytonutrients too. So I try and have a real honest conversation with them about depriving themselves of carbohydrates and could we do some other strategies to allow them to incorporate more carbohydrates into their meal plan. And then I kind of just keep this number in mind and tally up how much they're eating and see how far away they are from that. So here's a one serving of carbohydrate. These are of starches. So patients don't really understand, as you know, carb and starch, what those are and what a serving is. And that when I say carb, starch, and sugar, I basically those words are interchangeable in a lot of ways. So people in the public are confused about that. So we just want to clarify that a starch is a carbohydrate and a sugar is considered a carbohydrate so that they have a clear understanding. But anyways, here's some serving sizes. A half a cup of cooked beans is a serving size or 15 grams. Half a cup of corn. Here's that one-third cup of rice, small tortilla, half an English muffin, small potato. How many patients have come into you and said, "I'm not eating potatoes anymore. My doctor told me I can't eat any white food." Well, potatoes are a white food. Jicama is a white food. Cauliflower is a white food. And those are all good for us. So I think the real message is staying away from processed foods. But all of these are one serving of starch. And everybody responds differently to different types of starches. So I say use your meter. See how, when you eat cereal, what happens to your blood sugar. And I really do try and encourage them to eat the higher fiber cereals. Like when they look on the label, the fiber should say at least 3 grams per serving. That would be a really fiber-rich cereal. And they seem to have less trouble with those types of cereals. Now, what about fruit? People love fruit. Fruit's great for you. It comes in different colors. It has fiber and phytonutrients. So enjoy the fruit. Don't deprive yourself. And what I'll say is, just have 3 to 4 servings a day. See if you can work that in. Don't eat them all at once. Spread them out. Enjoy the fruit. Taste the fruit. Relish the fruit. 17 small grapes are just a cluster. And when I talk about fruit, I often use my hand as a sizing tool. So I close my fist and say, this is about how much fruit is one serving. For some reason, melon gets a bad rap. Melon's fine, just a cup of melon, not in a half a watermelon. But I do talk about fruit juice and say, you know what? I'd rather you eat the fruit, chew the fruit, enjoy the fruit than drink the juice. The juice goes down so quickly and you don't feel very satisfied. Something about chewing it and enjoying it increases your satisfaction and it helps us be mindful. Here's milk. So as I mentioned, an 8 ounce glass of milk has 12 grams of carbohydrate. And then if you look at these others like yogurt, they're going to have varying degrees of carbohydrate, but really encouraging our patients to read the label when it comes to yogurt because so many of the yogurts are just chock full of sugar. And even soy milk, people think, well, soy milk, it doesn't have carbohydrate. Yeah, it does. So looking at the label is another important teaching thing. Now here's our sweets. People with diabetes love sweets. People without diabetes love sweets. So I really try hard not to move into this thing where you can't have these sweets or my patients will tell me, I've given up ice cream. I'm like, you know what? If you're okay with that, let's keep it that way. But I do let them know that a half a cup of ice cream is 15 grams of carbohydrate. So they may want a special treat. A lot of times we negotiate that once a week they get a special treat. And then we figure out what that will be. And that seems to help people. It gives them something to look forward to, and they don't feel quite as deprived. A lot of people think, hey, sorbet is really good, but look, 1/4 cup of sorbet is 15 grams of carbohydrate. Might as well eat the ice cream and enjoy it. The other thing I love doing is sharing this list of superfoods with my patients. And I actually just print out this PowerPoint slide and I have it as a handout. And when they ask me, Bev, what should I eat? I'm like, these are superfoods, 10 superfoods that are high in nutrition, phytonutrients, high in fiber, and they're just great for your body. This came from the American Diabetes Association. And when I hand them this list of superfoods, it's like I've just given them a gift. And they're like, really? I can have sweet potatoes? I'm like, yes. Berries. I love berries, tomatoes. And it just shifts the whole dynamic of the conversation because so often they're used to being told what not to eat. And when we show them these are foods to enjoy, it can really be so beneficial to the counseling relationship and also their relationship with food. Nuts. I just want to point out that nuts are terrific. They're full of fiber and nutrients and protein, but they do pack in some calories. So when they're having nuts, you just want to make sure they stick to a handful of nuts and when they're eating those, not, having a bag of peanuts next to the computer and munching on those all day. Handful of nuts. Looking at labels is such a big deal for our patients. There's legislation now that is trying to update what the labels say. To make it clearer for people, even as a healthcare professional, it takes time to really understand what the label's trying to tell us. So if we're having trouble with it, how about the people that don't have any professional training in health? Wow, really difficult. But the first thing we're going to ask them to look at is the serving size. So serving size, they're going to standardize that with a new label, but now it's individualized based on the food product. So in this situation, it's a half a cup. And then next thing we're going to look at is total carbohydrate. So this has 13 grams of total carbohydrate for one serving. So we say it's about one serving of carb. But I do want to point out the fiber. Really, if it says 0 fiber or 1 gram of fiber, it's a processed food. So once you're moving into 2 and 3 grams of fiber, we know it's a better choice. Sugars. So this is complicated because sugars could be from the natural sugars occurring in the food or just added sugars. So if you look at a soda and you see that the soda has 40 grams of sugar in it, we know that's 10 teaspoons of sugar because 1 teaspoon of sugar equals 4 grams. And we know that there's no other source of sugar, a natural occurring sugar in that soda. It's just water and sugar and chemicals put together in this bottle. You can tell I'm not a big soda fan. And so Patients, I will say, look at the sugars, be aware of the sugar content, but it's part of the total carbohydrate. That's the ultimate number they want to look for. And the other thing I do have them look at is fat. And I do say if the fat calories are more than 30% of the total nutrients, it's probably more of a higher fat food. If you're trying to lose weight, that may not be the best choice for you. Label reading is really helpful for patients. And if you look at how people with diabetes are eating, and this is from the American Diabetes Association standard of care, currently people with diabetes get about 45% of their calories from carbohydrates, 30 to 40% from fat, and 16 to 18% from protein. So that's what they're currently doing on most people. So we want to help modify that and encourage them to get less than 10% of their calories from saturated fat. Ditch the trans fat and look at their total cholesterol. So as you know, fats are the most calorie dense. They're 9 calories per gram. And we want people to move more toward the monounsaturated and polyunsaturated fat sources and really limit the animal and saturated fats. Here's serving sizes, and that's like the tip of your thumb. It's your thumbnail. It's not that much, a lot of these serving sizes. So really thinking about portion control when you're eating these foods that are higher in fat. I mean, the great thing about fat is it satiates us. It makes us feel full. So fat has a role in weight management, but it's easy to eat more fat than you intended. And then trans fat, as I've mentioned earlier, there's a lot to eliminate it by 2016 because there's a strong link between diets high in trans fat and heart disease. So good news that we're not going to see this anymore. But anytime I tell my patients, look on the labels for hydrogenated or partially hydrogenated fat and stay away from those. Little Debbie, like that packaging, she's so sweet and has pictures with families gathered around her Twinkies and her Ho-Hos and all this stuff. But Little Debbie is not your friend. As a matter of fact, I told one of my patients, I go, you need to break up with Little Debbie. He's like, I love Little Debbie. I'm like, well, Little Debbie is not serving you well. And he came back to see me a week later and he goes, I broke up with Little Debbie. I'm like, good job. I'm going to go ahead and just move on and talk a little bit about this slide. This is interesting because the diabetes prevention program put on by the CDC, I went to their training and they actually, to help people lose weight, just focus on fat. They have them count up their fat grams that they take in a day. And so, for example, if my calorie goal is 1800, I want to eat 1800 calories a day, only 50 grams of, I should only consume 50 grams of fat, which is the 50 times 9 is 450 calories. So a very lowered fat intake. And they just have the patients measure fat off the label and add it up throughout the day. And they have really good success in weight loss. So I just want to share that concept with you, with our patients with diabetes who are trying to lose weight. Looking at the fat label might be a helpful addition in addition to portion control or the fat grams on the label. What about protein? So we used to tell people with diabetes and kidney disease to reduce their protein intake. And the new recommendations starting in 2015, it says with diabetes and kidney failure, reducing the amount of protein is not recommended. It does not improve outcomes. So we, again, we're only going to advise people to do things if there's science backing it up and if it shows that, yes, it's going to improve outcomes. The recommended daily allowance is 0.8 grams per kilogram per day of good quality protein. So I'm just giving you the RDA recommendations. These are different than the American Diabetes Association. This is our federal government recommendations, just as a reference point for this information. The thing about protein is it seems to stimulate insulin response. Really? Yeah, so a protein, if you're having a low blood sugar, don't eat a protein-rich food because it might actually trigger the pancreas to make more insulin. And I had a guy come in to see me and he said, oh, my provider told me to eat peanut butter when my blood sugar is low. And I was kind of worried about that because peanut butter has protein in it. So we changed over to just eating raisins, I believe, is what we chose for him. Well, he chose that for himself. So protein only has 4 calories per gram. Protein, you want to go lean, poultry, fish, egg, lean beef, and there's plant sources for protein. So, many plants contain amino acids and protein within them. So Many people eat plant-based diets and they're fine. Low-fat cottage cheese, mozzarella cheese. I'm really wanting to limit that high-fat protein because many of the proteins are mixed, dairy proteins obviously are mixed with fat, saturated fat. So really limiting that. Any animal protein is what I meant to say, not dairy protein. Animal proteins have fat and protein combined. So we just want to limit that. And then looking at the serving size, that a guy came in to see me, he's like, yeah, we have like a 12-ounce piece of steak for dinner. I'm like, 12 ounces? And so we just talked about the size of the palm of your hand is 3 ounces, and that's would kind of be a more recommended serving size. Okay, poll question number three. Which of the following is true about alcohol and diabetes? There's more than one right answer. Is it A, white wine increases blood sugars? B, men can have two drinks and women can have one drink a day? C, alcohol increases risk of hypoglycemia? D, if you're going to drink, eat a starchy food? E, a shot of tequila is better than a margarita. So there's more than one right answer. Which of these are correct? Okay, can you guys see this? Oh, good. There was like silence out there, so now good. I see that you are choosing answers. Okay, thank you. I'm going to go ahead and close this poll. Looks like most of you have voted and share your results. So white wine increases blood sugar. That is actually false. Wine, whether it's red wine or white wine, actually lowers blood sugar. So alcohol has a hypoglycemic effect on people, especially wine or hard liquor that's not part of a mixed drink definitely will cause low blood sugar. So A is not the right answer. B, each day men can have two drinks and women can have one drink. That is correct. C, alcohol increases risk of hypoglycemia. Yes, that is correct. D, if you are going to drink, eat a starch. That is absolutely right. Because alcohol can cause low blood sugar. And then E, a shot of tequila is better than a margarita. Well, I guess that's a question of of taste, but it is true because a margarita is packed full of sugar. And what happens a lot of times when people drink a mixed drink like that, their blood sugars actually might go high immediately after they drink that and then crash later on. So you'd rather you eat food and have a shot of tequila than drink that margarita. So maybe a diet, a skinny margarita would be a better choice. Okay, let's keep going. So here's the slide that talks about this. Women have one or fewer drinks a day, according to the American Diabetes Association, and then two or fewer drinks a day. And here's the portion size. I don't really, of course, encourage my patients to drink wine but or alcohol, but if they do drink, let's do it safely and always check with the provider first. Let's just take a look at Ms. Gonzalez, her daily meal plan. She has 5 corn tortillas, a half a cup of beans, salsa, peppers, and egg beaters for breakfast, and her blood sugars before lunch are in the 200s. And so if we think about her intake of carbohydrate, 5 corn tortillas is 5 servings. A half a cup of beans makes it 6 servings. Salsa is free. It's, tomatoes and garlic and all kinds of really healthy stuff. Peppers are free. Egg beaters are a protein. And so look at her blood sugars before lunch. They're obviously above target. So we might have this conversation with Ms. Gonzalez saying, Ms. Gonzalez, I just want to let you know that your blood sugars are above target before lunch. And when we see that, we look backward and we look at breakfast and see what's happening at breakfast. And let's just go over your breakfast plan and see how much carbohydrate you're eating, which one of these foods are carbohydrates. And so we're going to identify those with her. She may not know which foods raise her blood sugar. And we could say, well, these 5 corn tortillas are increasing your blood sugar and the beans. And then we would say to her, do you think you could cut back on one of those just to help get your blood sugars down? And she may say to you, yeah, let's go down to 4 corn tortillas and a half a cup of beans. What do we say then? We say, great, that would be excellent. Let's see how that affects your blood sugars before lunch. And if it isn't quite to target, we still have room. We can maybe look at going down to 3 corn tortillas if that would work for you. So we want to help patients make small goals and understand the relevance in their life. Instead of saying, we could say to her, oh my gosh, you're having 5 corn tortillas and a half a cup of beans, that's 6 servings of starch, that's way too much. If we say that, she's going to feel embarrassed. So we want to acknowledge that corn tortillas are super healthy. Beans are wonderful. They're one of our superfoods. I love these healthy food choices you're making. Can we just look at portions? And so we engage her and we make her part of the problem solving. And that's how we really want to approach helping people make successful behavior change that's going to last a lifetime. Why is she having this bowl of cereal at night? We could ask her. Maybe she's hungry. But in my experience, a lot of people at some point in their diabetes career were told, you know, have a bowl of cereal before you go to bed. They don't even need it. And so she may just be doing it out of habit, or maybe she's hungry. We need to find out. But I do want to say there's a lot of things Ms. Gonzalez is doing right. She's eating 4 meals a day. She's writing it down. She's tracking her blood sugars. And if you notice, she's trying to eat low salt food and low fat food. And she's getting some vegetables and beans and some superfoods in there. So you want to acknowledge what she's doing right and help her move to healthier choices. Okay, let's take a look at this. If someone with type 1 is underweight, what are some possible causes? Is it A, eating too much, sorry about that, junk food, B, celiac disease, C, a sit-down job, D, diabulimia, or E, gastroparesis? Which one could it be? Let me go ahead and launch this poll. So someone has type 1 and they're underweight. What could be some possible causes? Okay. Thanks for voting, everybody. I'm going to go ahead and close this and share it with you. So, yeah, I couldn't really trick you guys. You're like, oh, yeah, we know this answer. So B is right, celiac disease. And D, diabulimia. Yeah, certainly can lead to some weight loss and gastroparesis too. So let's talk about those a little bit more in these next upcoming slides. So celiac disease affects about 10% of people with type 1 diabetes, and certainly with newly diagnosed type 1 diabetes, we're going to consider evaluating for celiac disease on initial diagnosis, and certainly we're going to watch them throughout their life because they're at higher risk for celiac disease. At any point in their life, they could express this. So it's an immune reaction to gluten, and it actually affects the villi of the intestine. So here's a little villi that help move the intestinal contents down. And when there's this gluten intolerance and autoimmune reaction to gluten, look what happens to the villi. They become inflamed, and so inflamed that these little crypts are closed, and these crypts are where food is absorbed in the intestines and the intestinal lining. So it really results in malabsorption and their weight loss, fatty stools, diarrhea, failure to thrive, muscle tenderness, blood sugar is really wacky, out of control. And how do we diagnose this? Well, we look at their symptoms, of course, and then we look at their blood. And we look for anti-endometrial antibodies, or we look for tissue transglutaminase. If those come back positive, then we know that they might be expressing celiac disease. And we have to refer to a GI specialist for an endoscopy and a biopsy to confirm diagnosis. And once they're diagnosed, they need to be gluten-free for life. And that is a big task. Thank goodness the new labeling laws have really helped to help people with celiac disease to identify what foods do contain gluten. So they need to avoid wheat, rye, barley, And sometimes oats have some gluten in them from cross-contamination and processing, so they might need to limit that too. Definitely referring to a dietitian who's knowledgeable in these areas. And once a person has celiac disease, we're looking for other associated autoimmune disorders that I've listed here. So type 1 diabetes and celiac go together, and they're much more likely to express thyroid disease. So we just need to keep an eye out for these. Here's some examples of gluten-containing foods. It's in everything. So really in unexpected places. So label reading becomes really important to these families. And when they go out to people's houses, informing them about products that do contain gluten. That's a big commitment. Poll question five. John has gastroparesis. What is the best recommendation? Should he A, eat raw vegetables and limit fruit? B, eat low fiber small meals. C, always take insulin after meals. Or D, avoid foods containing wheat. What is the right answer? Avoid foods containing wheat. I think I said that right. Thanks for voting, everybody. All right. Take one more second. Thank you. I'm going to go ahead and close this poll and share it with you. So you all chose exactly the right answer. It's to eat low fiber small meals. And that is really hard for us because we're all about the fiber and, eating healthfully. And with gastroparesis, the problem is that there's delayed stomach emptying due to nerve damage. So the food goes into the stomach and it sits there and it doesn't get propelled on to the duodenum. It's delayed in its propulsion because the nerves that innervate the stomach and move the content forward are damaged from nerve disease. How do we know that people have this? Well, they'll complain of nausea after eating, vomiting after eating. If they take insulin, a fast-acting insulin, before they eat, they're at more risk for post-meal hypoglycemia because the food is still in their stomach. It hasn't been absorbed, but the insulin went ahead and worked. So there's this mismatch. These people really struggle, and the best treatment to improve gastroparesis is to get blood sugars down. As blood sugars improve, stomach transit time generally gets better, just depending on the degree of damage. They've tried pacers. There's some medications they can use. It's difficult. And so we really want to help patients avoid getting into this place by keeping their A1C as close to 7 or less than possible. Because once you get it, it just really makes management difficult. And many patients with gastroparesis will say, go ahead and eat your food and then give your insulin later to match the gastric emptying time. And certainly they will have diagnostic tests done, like gastric emptying studies, to see how long it takes for that food to go through. The other thing that is more common in type 1 boys and girls and throughout their lifespan is diabulimia. And this is a disordered eating, and it's when a person with type 1 diabetes takes less insulin than they need. And when you take less insulin than you need, or you avoid insulin, your blood sugars go up and you can drop your body weight very quickly. It's not healthy. And I've worked with patients who had one gal who was type 1, had diabulimia, and she was a certified diabetes educator. It is not a knowledge deficit. They need mental health counseling by a professional who's really knowledgeable about disordered eating. And because with diabetes and disordered eating, when you eliminate or take less insulin than you need, the risk of complications just goes through the roof, and it's just so dangerous. What are some signs? Unexplainable spikes. The A1C doesn't match the blood sugars. They're not really checking their blood sugars. They're not refilling their medications or their insulin. And they definitely need, intervention, immediate intervention. Okay, well, for the last half hour, we're going to talk about exercise. We call it activity. That's the new word we're supposed to be calling exercise. And we're going to talk about the American Diabetes Association and College of sports medicine recommendations. We'll look at benefits, barriers, precautions, helping patients set an activity plan, and then adjustment and monitoring of food and medications. Let's do a poll question. Which of the following are accurate exercise recommendations for people with diabetes? And there's more than one right answer. Is it A, exercise must be done daily for 30 minutes to be effective? B, must get stress tests before starting an exercise program? C, try not to miss more than 2 consecutive days of exercise? D, incorporate resistance training 2 days a week? Or last, both A and B. Let me launch this poll and see what you all think. Thanks for voting, everyone. I really appreciate it. This is exercise is really so important for diabetes. And there's more and more research supporting the importance of it. We'll talk about that. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close this poll. Thanks for voting. I'm used to seeing you all live and in person, so doing these polls helps me get that feedback that I love so much. Okay, nobody chose A. You're right. It doesn't have to be done 30 minutes every day to be effective. We know that, if you can do 3 10-minute bouts during the day, that's great, and try and do it, accumulate 150 minutes a week. B is also not right. We used to say you have to get a stress test before starting an exercise program, but if a person has type 2 diabetes or in their 30s, 40s, 50s, they have no risk of, they have no history of cardiovascular disease, they have no, they're not smoking, or, they just have a low risk heart disease presentation, we don't need to get a stress test, and I'll talk about that. Because what they were finding is that it didn't really help avoid mortality, morbidity, getting a stress test. All it really did was stop people from exercising, so they've modified that recommendation. But C is right. Try not to miss more than 2 consecutive days. And D is right. Incorporate resistance training 2 days a week. So those are kind of new for all of us. And let's talk about how to make this happen. So for the kids, we need to encourage our kids to do 60 minutes of physical activity a day. Get off the computer, get outside, and move around. For adults, 150 minutes a week of moderate exercise, and spread it over at least 3 days of the week. Don't miss more than 2 days of exercise, and don't sit. I need to add that into this, but I'll tell you verbally, don't sit for more than 90 minutes at a time. That's a new recommendation also. Get up every 90 minutes. And then we need to talk about resistance training. So I just thought I'd define for you what is physical activity. Well, physical activity is just, movement that requires more energy than resting. So that's just like maybe getting up and going to the bathroom or doing laundry. That would be activity. Exercise is planned activity that includes structured and repetitive body movements. You actually are engaging in something to maintain physical fitness. And then sedentary behavior is these two kids on the video, little or no movement. So that's how we define it. Physical activity is getting up and moving. Exercise is kind of a planned activity that is repetition involved and uses major muscle groups. So progressive resistance exercise. And this is really important to talk to our patients about, because muscles use about 85% of the sugar in our bloodstream. Muscles use 85% of the sugar. And if we lose muscle mass, which happens to a lot of people over time, they're moving less, they're not engaging their body as much, they're sitting more, they're losing muscle mass and gaining more fat. As you gain more fat, you become more insulin resistant. If you can regain your muscle mass, you have better balance, you feel better, you're stronger, you're more physically fit, and you burn more sugar. So this is really important. Examples include exercise with free weights, weight machines. You can get those bands and do resistance exercise. You can use your body to do resistance exercise. So anything that we're engaging muscle, burning fuel, using our muscles on a regular basis is really important. So each session consists of at least one set of 5 or more resistant exercises using large muscle groups. And here's just an example of a gal using a free weight and doing some arm curls there. Benefits of exercise. Exercise, as I've mentioned, is so important. It improves insulin sensitivity, reduces cardiovascular risk. It helps us maintain weight loss. So once we lose that weight, it supports maintaining that weight that you're currently at. And it contributes to well-being. It's an antidepressant, and it helps people with balance. A lot of our older patients really struggle with balance and just doing the activities of daily living. So by being physically active, they can maintain independence and avoid falls and get their blood sugars down. I tell patients a lot, like doing exercise, let's say you walk for 10 minutes after dinner, which I really encourage my patients to do, get up and move after meals. That seems to be one of the most effective ways to get blood sugars down. So that activity after a meal is like taking 2 units of insulin. So I'm equivalating it. That's not a word. I'm equating insulin to activity. Like if you do 10 minutes of activity, maybe that's 1 unit of insulin. If you do 30 minutes, that's 3 units of insulin. And that seems to be a very effective strategy to help people to get moving, because truly exercise is medicine. Just like food is as medicinal. Food is medicinal. Exercise is a vital component of prevention as well as management of type 2. They're saying that it's the underlying muscle resistance to insulin that might be the causation of type 2 diabetes. So getting our muscles reactivated seems very important. Exercise can help improve the metabolic abnormalities associated with progression from pre-diabetes or insulin resistance to diabetes. For type 1, we're going to really focus on adjusting insulin to allow for safe participation. And I've talked to so many type 1s who are athletes, and they just cut their insulin doses in half practically from this physical activity. So when they're physical and doing exercise, insulin needs drop dramatically, and that's both for type 1 and type 2, so we need to account for that. So this gets back to that pre-exercise evaluation. How do we evaluate if it's safe for somebody to exercise? Well, we're going to use our clinical judgment, and if we're not sure, we'll check in with the provider. But we want to encourage high-risk patients, so maybe very overweight patients, patients with some high blood pressure, to start with low intensity in short time. I just met with this patient, and she goes, "I try and walk for a half an hour. I'm so winded after I walk. I just have to lay down and take a nap." And so I said, "Hey, why don't you just try 10 minutes? And maybe if you do 10 minutes, you'll be successful, and you won't feel so exhausted, and you'll be more likely to do it." And she goes, "That's a great idea." And so we want to make sure people aren't overdoing it. Start slowly, gradually build up. And if you're short of breath, we really need to relook at this. But there are contraindications to certain types of exercise. If they're uncontrolled hypertension, so when I was mentioning hypertension, I mean people who have hypertension who are taking medications to manage it. But if their blood pressures are wildly, or elevated, we need to be very cautious and talk to the provider. If they have any autonomic or peripheral neuropathy, so they may not be able to sense problems with their feet, or if they're exercising, they may not be able to sense that they're overdoing it. So we need to evaluate for those risk factors. If they have a history of foot problems, unstable proliferative retinopathy, you certainly don't want them to do any weight bearing. Anybody with eye problems, with any vessel disease in their eyes, weightlifting can increase the pressure and worsen that. So we just want to be thoughtful of exercise and what's safe for the patient, and always check in with a provider if we have any questions. So patients with complications require a more thorough assessment. And definitely, we want to have our patients talk to their provider before starting exercise. If they have chest pain, shortness of breath, if they have leg cramps, head, shoulder, neck, or back aches, any explained pain above the belt line should be considered cardiac in origin until proven otherwise. So identifying with patients that if you have any of these problems, let your provider know, let's stop the exercise right away. So really helping our patients do the exercise safely. Okay, poll question number 7. What are some exercise precautions for people with diabetes? A, carry some form of ID on you at all times. B, always have a snack if your blood sugar is less than 100. C, look for signs of hypoglycemia for up to 24 hours after exercise. D, carry a snack with you during exercise. Or E, let someone know your route. What precautions should we recommend for them? And there's more than one right answer on this one. Okay, thanks for voting, everybody. We'll take one more second. Okay, all of you have voted. Thank you. Let's go over these together. So definitely always carrying some form of identification. Very important. What if they pass out or they get into an accident and they're out exercising? We need to know who they are and how to get them help. B, always have a snack of blood glucose less than 100. Okay, this is not the right answer. This is kind of a tricked answer because I use the word always in there. So what if they're on metformin? Or what if they have diabetes and they're not taking anything? Do they really need a snack if their blood sugar is less than 100? Probably not. The only reason they would need a snack in this situation is if they're on sulfonylureas or insulin. Then they would need a snack if they're going to do some vigorous exercise for more than a half an hour. So we really need to base this on the patient and their situation. What about C? Look for signs of hypoglycemia 24 hours after exercise. Yes, that's absolutely true because exercise can affect blood sugars for up to 24 hours after you do the activity. And a lot of patients who exercise during the day get hypoglycemic in the middle of the night, especially if they're not used to exercise. You'll see a lot of our patients seasonally, for example, if they have to shovel snow or rake up leaves or mow the lawn, and they don't usually do that, they're high risk for low blood sugar, of course, if they're on a sulfonylurea or insulin. D, carry a snack with you? Yes, always do that. And E, yes, that's the right answer, always. Letting someone know where you're at in case you don't return, you get low blood sugar, you want to make sure somebody knows where you're exercising so they can come find you if you don't come back, within a certain time. So, duration of hypoglycemia risk. During exercise, the person with diabetes, if they're on sulfonylureas or insulin, is at risk for hypoglycemia because the muscles use that sugar that's existing in the bloodstream. So muscles need sugar for fuel, and so exercise increases the muscles' utilization of that glucose for fuel. So the risk of hypoglycemia can happen during exercise, immediately after, and then post-exercise late hypoglycemia, late onset hypoglycemia, is more common in type 1. So type 1s who inject insulin, their body isn't that can't regulate the insulin amount automatically. They're more likely to get that hypoglycemia, especially at night. And if they do moderate to high intensity exercise that lasts for more than 30 minutes, but even 4 to 15 hours after an exercise session and up to 24, they can be at risk for hypoglycemia. But the 4 to 15 hours are the highest risk time for hypoglycemia. So to help our patients prevent hypoglycemia, if planned activity, adjust insulin in anticipation of activities. Like I have a lot of patients who are older, they're on maybe 70/30 insulin, or they're on bolus insulin before meals. I say in the days you're going to go out and exercise, you want to cut back on your insulin by a certain amount of units because that exercise has a value of 5 units of insulin for you. So if a patient's on, let's say for example, 20 units of 70/30 before breakfast, I might say let's cut back 5 units of 70/30 if you're going to exercise between, breakfast and lunch. And if they're on, let's say 10 units of fast-acting bolus insulin before a meal, I might say let's cut back to 7. So I base it on that patient and what their blood sugars are and how insulin sensitive they are. And then we base it on their history of their response to exercise too. So it's all customized. Exercise recommendations are customized to the patient based on their insulin levels, how much insulin they inject based on their body weight, and based on the history. So it takes time to figure this out, but I always like to err on the side of caution. And then patients keeping a log is really important before exercise and after to see how exercise does affect their blood sugars. And here's some more strategies. Carry fast-acting carb source. So if they're on insulin, they might have to carry a glucagon emergency kit, but for sure, just carry some fast-acting source of sugar. And that could be raisins, glucose tabs. I don't really like Lifesavers because you have to eat 7 Lifesavers to e equal 15 grams of carbohydrate. Extra carbohydrate might be required after exercise, and watch out with alcohol and exercise. That can really lead to danger. So if the blood sugar is less than 100 and they're on insulin or secretagogues, a 15-gram snack is required. And then here's a really nice chart by Dana Armstrong. And she gathered this from the ADA Standards of Care, but she talks about intensity of exercise, duration, and then how much carbohydrate to cover for that if they're on insulin or secretagogues. So poll question number 8. Which of the following is a SMART goal? A, I will lose 5% of my body weight. B, I will eat less sugary foods during the week. C, I will monitor my blood sugars on a regular basis. Or D, I will eat one less bag of chips every day for 1 week. Or E, I'm not sure. So what is a SMART goal anyways? A SMART goal, well, let's find out. But just take a guess which one of these you think is a SMART goal, a behavior change goal for a person with diabetes. All right, thanks for voting, everybody. Okay, I'm gonna go ahead and close this poll and share your results. You guys are on fire. 100% of you chose D. I will eat one less bag of chips every day for 1 week. And so a SMART goal is, the SMART stands for, well, I'll just go to the next slide because it's right there. Oh, well, I'm going to go to the next slide and we'll go back. It stands for setting goals that are specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, and timely. And so when you think about the bag of chips, the reason that that was the right answer is because it was specific, one last bag of chips, and then it says every day, and it's time limited for 1 week. These others, a lot of my patients say, well, I want to lose 10 pounds. That's really not a goal, because how do we get there? Well, we have to get there by changing behavior, and then we want to identify what the behavior change is and then quantify it. So let's take a look at Julie here. Julie currently walks her dog 3 times a week around the block. Is this exercise? And what new and revised SMART goal could you set with her? So is that exercise? She walks a dog around the block 3 times a week? Well, absolutely it is. And maybe she comes in to see us and she says, well, I'm worried about my blood sugars are running higher than normal. And then we get to talking to her, and then we say, well, what do you think it actually helped get your blood sugars closer to target? And then she goes, you know what? Maybe I could exercise some more. So then what we could say, instead of, well, so we could say something like this then. Well, you should be walking your dog around the block, 7 days a week. That's kind of our natural response, because we think people should exercise every day, but that's probably not realistic for her. So we might say something to her like, Julie, would you be willing to walk the dog around the block 2 times? Well, she might say to us, hey, I could do that. I'm walking the dog around the block 1 time. I think I could do 2 times a week. Or we could even say to her, what do you think you could do to increase your activity? And I'm always surprised by what people come up with, because they generally know themselves better than anybody else. And she might say to us, well, you know what? Maybe on the days I don't walk the dog, I could actually do some weightlifting activity. Oh, that's a great idea. I never would have thought of that. So a lot of times as we're talking to patients, we're going to listen to what they're working toward, what they want to achieve and accomplish, and then help them figure out what they think they could do to achieve these goals, and then help them quantify it. And the other thing we do a lot with patients is help them make their goals realistic. Many of my patients say, well, I'm going to start, walking 7 days a week. And I'm saying, well, that's a great goal. I love that goal. But why don't we make it, you know, a little more realistic to give you some wiggle room not to do it perfectly? Why don't we say 5 days a week, and if you do seven, that's an extra bonus. So I negotiate a lot with clients to help them set goals that are realistic for them that they can achieve, because if they don't achieve the goal, they feel like they're failing, and they're not failing. Any intention and any degree of trying counts. So we really want to let them know it's difficult to make these behavior changes. We're going to support you. Let's keep it realistic, and let's prepare for setbacks too. And I love this saying by Nelson Mandela: the greatest glory in living lies not in never falling, but in rising every time we fall. And certainly when you have to live with a chronic condition for the rest of your life, we know setbacks are going to happen. We know that we can't do it perfectly all the time. So we want to help our patients prepare for that and then have a plan to get back up again. And that's where ongoing follow-up is so important with our patients, having a support group or checking in with them, you know, every 6 months to a year. The American Diabetes Association guidelines say we should check in with our patients on an ongoing basis, since diabetes is a chronic condition that really people benefit from support and coaching on an ongoing basis. So it looks like we've come to the end of our program. I want to thank all of you for joining us today. I appreciate all you're doing out there in the communities and your work setting and with your families and neighbors to improve diabetes care. If you have any questions after this webcast, we'll be happy to answer them. You can email us. And also, I'll be staying for a few minutes afterward to answer any questions and reply to your questions. So thanks so much for joining us. I'm going to press the stop recording button, but I will be available for any questions afterwards. This is Beverly Tomasian signing off.